Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 68, section 6, which is old single column, page 769. All right, we have this final section in this paper. And I think for an introduction, I'm going to take us through those final two little paragraphs of the preceding section. You can see there in section 5, the primary thing that they did was to give just little thumbnail sketches of those four stages building up to agriculture, you know, starting with collectors and then hunters and then herders and then farmers. And you may recall at the end they were stressing that the importance of that agricultural stage, that it's not merely the pinnacle, as it immediately appears that you're building up to that high point. Yeah, it's a high point of the early stages of the evolution of civilization, but it becomes the foundation, and must be an enduring foundation for any greater civilization going forward. And so let me just read those two paragraphs and give you some, remind you of some of the things we touched upon at the end of the last session, and then also give you a little bit more to get us spun up for this, for section 6. Okay, so those two little paragraphs at the end there. It says, human society has evolved from the hunting stage through that of the herders to the territorial stage of agriculture. And each stage of this progressive civilization was accompanied by less and less of nomadism. More and more man began to live at home. Okay, and that last little point, the home is a very important foundational element for civilization. But the other issues there. Notice the main contrast that they have there is between what they call a territorial stage, in contrast to nomadism. The other parallel development that's going on is you're starting with clans, and then moving to tribes, and then to nations, and then to territorial states. See that same word there, territorial stage of agriculture. With clans and tribes, those can definitely still be very nomadic peoples. But the fundamental transition from tribe to nation, besides just a bigger group, is that a nation is not just a people like a tribe is. A nation is a people of a place. Okay? And then, obviously, territorial state, besides, you know, the concept, that advanced concept of a state with laws, right? Having that adjective to emphasize the territory is continuing on. Again, it's a people of a place, and they've just advanced from merely mores to laws and the other more advanced aspects of a state. But see, that transition, that's in parallel to this. See, you've got to get to agriculture if you're going to have an enduring nation phenomenon, not to mention a state.
Just a quick question here. Yep. You know, normally you think of the states in America making up the nation versus versus coming after it. Maybe I'm just semantics here. Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, when you know, when we're saying territorial state, we mean not a sort of a lesser, more specific usage, like calling it the 50 states, although they are states in the more general sense too. But we'll eventually get to those issues of what is statehood, contrary to prior things, prior to more primitive concepts or constructs. But technically, to use that word state, in a very sort of general, just concept fashion, is that you are introducing more abstract constructs. You aren't just sort of going with your gut anymore. You're getting very reflective about your nationhood, and you are beginning to bring in more personal abstract concepts, like I said, like laws. You know, it isn't just something inside of you. There's this abstraction of the law externally that everyone is putting themselves in cooperative subordination to, those sorts of things. All the sophistication of a state. In the United States, right, you're taking that sophistication of a state, but you're putting an umbrella over a collection of those states, and having a greater state, right? I mean,
Why do they call it United Nations then? Are they really United States?
So in a bigger sense, when you're thinking about the globe, you can begin to think about more of a global sort of phenomenon once you have nations. You don't have to have everyone up to the abstraction of statehood all over the planet or over a region of the planet. If you get them up to nations, then you can think about international. Right? Eventually, all those nations are states, too, as they continue to evolve. But until they are people of a place, until they're nations, you really don't have the potential for that more global sort of a phenomena, where, say, the global government of, behind the scenes, like the Master Seraphim come in. Those are the angels of nation life, right? They're not the angels of tribal life or clan life. There's no potential there. You have to get to nations before you can have that kind of top-down engagement by the planetary government, because until the people get up to the minimum level that they're reaching down to, there's no interface possible.
Right, yeah,
and that's the nation level, is when you've gotten up to where they reach down to. Okay, but anyway, see, back to this. So you see that's what they're hinting at between the lines of that territorial stage of agriculture, is that once you get to agricultural, now you can. You have this this foundational element in place that's indispensable to nations and the subsequent states. Okay, and you want to appreciate, as they're about to state here in this next paragraph, that this isn't some passing thing. This is an ongoing foundational necessity. No matter how high you're going to build, there has to be a ground floor to the building. And that agricultural stage is part of that ground, that foundation. Okay, then they go on and they say, and now is industry supplementing agriculture, with consequently increased urbanization and multiplication of non-agricultural groups of citizenship classes. But an industrial era cannot hope to survive if its leaders fail to recognize that even the highest social developments must ever rest upon a sound agricultural basis. Like I was just stressing there. Now, the fullness of why that is. Recall last time I was pointing out, as they were bringing up this issue of land, that we are humans, and we are up from the humus. Right? Our material mind, you know, is predicated on literal matter. Without that, you know, literal land foundation, you're floating. Right? You need that for the humans that are the citizens of your civilization to be grounded. Okay, so just the fact that we're humans, you know, is important. And then remember, they were bringing up the land man ratio as they were talking about it. And I mentioned one of the other issues in play, that why it's important that, you know, it must ever rest. You know, it's one of those must sentences. You know, see, must ever rest upon a sound agricultural basis, because you have a fundamental coupling between matter and spirit, between power and personality, moving through the evolutionary process towards a power-personality synthesis. That's another reason why it's a must, right? Because it's fundamentally part of greater personality actualization, is predicated on greater and greater synchronization, coordination with the other half of the universe. It's not just all about persons, and they can sort of just float, you know, in nowhere space, you know, like some people imagine. No, everything, you know, even those residents of the Isle of Paradise are grounded on matter, and everyone's domiciled on a material abode. Because, you know, it's not because they're all humans, right? See, it's this deeper fact that there's this fundamental coupling between energy pattern and spirit pattern, between power and personality. Right? Neither are complete without the other, because they're really two sides of one coin. It just appears that they're two separate facts, but they really aren't. They're one fact, two sides of one fact. Okay? There's all these reasons, and you can, you know, go on even, there's even more that you can bring up about why that's a must ever rest. No matter how fancy you get, you still have to eat, right? I mean, you know, there's also issues like that. Obviously, you need something producing food for the people, no matter how industrial or technological they get, right? Right, we imagine science fiction things where you don't need agriculture. You know, you just have this magic box that makes food out of nothing, right? You know, take some raw energy source and, you know, and makes you a cup of Earl Grey or whatever, right?
Charge extra if you do it the old style.
So just wanted to stress that, as you'll see, they're gonna bring that up right away as we get into this this next section. That's a very important foundation, and there was a time back at the beginning of the 20th century when we were kind of getting off in these fantasy lands. We've started to come back around and recognize that you can't just somehow live in the absence, like you've outgrown agriculture or something, right? You know, but there was kind of a time when we were sort of getting ahead of ourselves, you know, all that exciting flying cars and whatnot stuff, and we were thinking that we could just, you know, sort of live above the ground in some, you know, fairyland. All right, so let's see where they go next here.
6, evolution of culture. Man is a creature of the soil, a child of nature. No matter how earnestly he may try to escape from the land, in the last reckoning, he is certain to fail. Dust you are, and to dust you shall return, is literally true of all mankind. The basic struggle of man was, and is, and ever shall be, for land. The first social associations of primitive human beings were for the purpose of winning these land struggles. The land-man ratio underlies all social civilization.
Okay, so you can see we've already talked about a number of those issues. Note how they end that that last sentence of that paragraph. It underlies all social civilization. So in that one, you see their adjective is merely social. You notice that the title of the section is The Evolution of Culture. So we're thinking about going beyond mere evolution, the evolution of merely society, right, to that higher level of the evolution of culture. And so we want to be looking for things in this section that start to bring in, you know, religious, quasi-religious elements, spiritual elements, so that, you know, to see that you're getting to culture and not merely society. But obviously the foundation, as they're pointing out, see, is that merely social civilization. Okay, and then they're stressing, man is a creature of the soil. We were just doing the up from the humus thing, right? That's what they're speaking, they're referring to there between the lines. But they bring in an additional little element there, quoting Genesis, dust you are, and to dust shall you return. It's more than the fact that you're a human. As I was saying a little bit ago, remember, your mortal self is a material mind, right, that's predicated on matter. When the matter is no longer there as a predicate, that self is not there. Okay. Between the lines there is, that to dust you shall return. I mean, no mortal self is resurrected. Right? You notice how they're wanting you to think about this in very definitive terms. Is literally true of all mankind. Doesn't matter if we're talking about Jesus or me or you or who we're talking about. Right? The mortal self, it's literally true, it returns to the dust. Right? There's no resurrection of mortal selves. That's why they're called mortal selves. Right? If something's going to be resurrected, it needs to be potentially immortal, not mortal. Right? So your adjutant, your material mind, that mortal self, to dust, it shall return. Literally true. So there's that kind of backdrop, but again, it's just further stressing that the adjutant mind that's talking to you right now is predicated on the land. Right? It can't exist without that grounding on the land. We can't get so science fiction-y fanciful to think otherwise. Like they said, no matter how earnestly he may try to escape from the land, right, in the last reckoning, he is certain to fail. Right? Anyone that tries to set up a society predicated on one of these fanciful notions that we can imagine and write stories about, that society will fail. Right? They're trying to stress that. Because, see, they knew that we were starting to get kind of, over the end of our skis here on this stuff. Trying to, live up an imaginary life. Okay. And again, just stressing, that it doesn't matter if you're in the seventh stage of light and life, this is still the case. Right? The basic struggle of man was and is and ever shall be for land. So effort, struggle, conflict, right? See the struggle there. Right? You don't, just because you're in the seventh stage of light and life doesn't mean you still don't have the basic physics of effort, struggle, conflict. You still have material minds predicated on the land. You still have to have a definitive coordination with the land. Yeah, it's going to be very sophisticated and fancy way up there in the seventh stage of light and life compared to now. Right? But you have this in the central universe, Right? The beings don't exist independent of the land. They exist fully harmonized with the land, like we've talked about a number of times. Okay, so that's, you know, when you think about people that have lost sight, our intellectuals that have lost sight of the importance of the land, of agriculture, you can see how that could be just another element that's a falsehood that's pushing us toward a collapse of civilization. That's that separation from the land. Think about how many urban people, you know, are just completely divorced from this sort of grounding, you know, and their thoughts manifest this divorcement from a solid grounding. Right? They have all sorts of fanciful false notions in their head. I mean, you've got supposedly educated people, you know, that think that white milk comes from, you know, light cows and chocolate milk comes from brown cows. Right? You can do a survey and get a huge percentage of people that believe that. Right? I mean, that's, you know, that's just a simple example of how separate. So when those people think about politics, what are their thought processes going to be like? How ungrounded are their thought processes going to be? Right? It begins very simple, something that doesn't seem to be that that important, but it is. You know, it means your whole mind doesn't have a foundation under it. And so the farther you get above where the foundation should be, you know, trying to think about abstract state-level government thoughts, there's going to be no logic or order, you know, in people's minds up there, that far removed from this absence of a grounding. So that's one of the things we see a lot. All right, let's see, anything else there?
That's why we have a real estate agent as president.
All right, I mean, there's just a lot of reasons why, you know, I mean, the degree to which the whole could coordinate things, coincidentally, you'll find, you know, a conspiracy where stuff gets regrounded one way or another. You know, who gets elected or, you know, what events occur. There's, you know, the universe is trying to keep us grounded. They want the best for us. They don't want us to be a test case of just how hopeless a collapse can be, right? They're trying to keep us grounded.
Just the opposite.
Yeah.
How wonderful a collapse.
Okay, what else do they say here?
Man's intelligence, by means of the arts and sciences, increased the land yield. At the same time, the natural increase in offspring was somewhat brought under control, and thus was provided the sustenance and leisure to build a cultural civilization.
Okay, so notice there. See the contrast. See how the two paragraphs end. The first one ended social civilization. This one ends cultural civilization. All right, so the second paragraph is about building something upon that foundation, building culture upon mere society foundation. And you've got to bring in the arts and the sciences. And remember, by arts, we don't just mean, you know, painting and sculpting, right? I mean, general, all are artisans, you know, including very, material, technological, whatnot artisans. Artisans at engine repair, you know, whatever. But notice how they're leveraging the discussion off of the land. You can increase the land yield when you get a little bit more scientific intelligence. Plus, you can have a little bit more causal understanding of how reproduction works, and you can begin to get, you know, that, you know, like they say, somewhat brought under control. And so between the two, you you begin to have the potential for moving out of just the nutrition epic and the security age into the material comfort era. And you can see the sustenance and leisure, right, to build a cultural civilization. So in a number of ways, we're seeing how you know, you're moving up to agriculture, you're moving up to nations and states, you're moving up to the material comfort era, quivering on the very brink of moving into the quest for knowledge and wisdom. Okay, that's what. Keep going here.
Human society is controlled by a law which decrees that the population must vary directly in accordance with the land arts and inversely with a given standard of living. Throughout these early years, even more than at present, the law of supply and demand as concerned men and land determined the estimate value of both. During the times of plentiful land, unoccupied territory, the need for men was great, and therefore the value of human life was much enhanced. Hence, the loss of life was more horrifying. During periods of land scarcity and associated overpopulation, human life became comparatively cheapened, so that war, famine, and pestilence were regarded with less concern.
Okay, so now they're going to set up, you know, see, we had a large paragraph break, and so we're shifting gears. They're setting up this basic tension that they want to speak to here, basically in the rest of the remaining part of the section. And a key measure of this tension is population, is that simple quantity measure of the situation. You know, and you can see the initial directly proportional, inversely proportional statement they're making. You know, obviously, you get more sophisticated with the land arts, you can have more population. But if you want higher standard of living, you know, you're going to have to, that's inversely proportional. You know, you can't have a million people per square foot and have any sort of decent standard of living. So that, you know, the basic mathematics of that population measure, the fact that they bring in supply and demand as concerned men and land, they're reminding you that as they're saying there throughout these early ages, right, when you're in the early stages of civilization, it's a very material, you know, sort of a mechanical sort of a situation. You don't have a lot of injection of the spontaneity, the originality of personality. You're very much just a material phenomenon that obeys basic laws like supply and demand, and you think, you know, what human consciousness you have is predicated on that basic dynamics. So you notice they talk about estimated value there of both. You're seeking some facts to identify that word value to. I mean, technically value is a spirit word, but you're not there yet. And as we've talked about many times, we still aren't there yet. We don't literally have a third energy, you know, spirit substance, in contrast to mind energy and physical energy. We don't even, still we don't have that. So we end up using the spirit words for mind and material issues. Right? But, it's those spiritual concepts are the motivation, you know, they're the drivers within you, right? And so, you know, how much value do you assign to these blobs of protoplasm, and how much value do you assign to these patches of dirt?
I don't know, that keeps going up all the time.
Right? We all know it fluctuates a lot. And at times it can get very artificial and out of whack, you know, more and more so in recent times, because we've gotten, we had a number of our, institutions aren't grounded as they should be, so they're going off on these arbitrary tangents like this. But just, you know, back to the basics here that they're bringing out, right? If you've got unoccupied territory, plentiful land, you know, you get, wow, the potential of all that. You know, if only we had the humans to tap all that potential. So, you know, it's like breed everyone, breed, you know. And humans are very valuable. We need them to actualize all the potential
more
of all this.
For the kingdom.
Right. You know, and so you know, if someone dies, it's a horrible circumstance. But, right, if it flips around, like they're saying, land scarcity or associated overpopulation, and it's like, boy, you know, it'd be nice if something culled the herd here a little bit. A famine, cool. right? Or, wow, a definitive plague of disease here, right? Some pestilence. Right? Or war. Right? So, you know, just, you know, think about that. You know, don't go, well, we're beyond that. This dynamics is there. Right, we'll be getting eventually to talking about war more. You know, the why it's one of the indispensables. You're seeing it here. Right, it's a natural part of this very material system that it's, you know, that allows it to be self-correcting, because you don't have very objective humans yet that can learn by looking and, you know, can just guide this with a very objective perspective. You know, it has to be, you know, have the checks and balances built into just the energetics of the material system. And, so war, famine, and pestilence solve the problem. When there gets to be too many people per square foot, okay, yeah, you don't have to worry about it. Basically, it takes care of itself. They're going to die of something or other. They get too annoying to each other, and they'll just kill each other, or, you know, disease will spread like wildfire, and they'll all die off, or whatever. That's the way it's designed. That those aren't, war, famine, and pestilence aren't something sent by Satan, you know, or the devil, or Lucifer. You know, they aren't, you know, manifestations of that other stuff, that black evil ooze stuff, you know, that's constantly assaulting us. No, they're part of God's plan. They're part of the natural system He built. You don't need divine intervention to fix these problems. God has built the solution into the system. War, famine, and pestilence is the system that God designed to take care of that in the early stages.
We really need that in this area. However, it doesn't seem to be happening. Now
it's birth control.
Yeah, well, we'll be getting to that.
In this general area where we live. Oh.
But just, yeah, remember, we're one of the things we're trying to do is to take our spiritual consciousness that in recent times, you know, all of us have tended to get a little bit over-idealized. We need to face some facts again. The revelators are trying to give us the facts. War, famine, and pestilence have their place. I mean, in a very primitive situation, there's a goodness there. But all good things taken to extreme become bad, right? I mean, obviously, you don't. War, famine, and pestilence don't exist in eternity, right? But they definitely exist in time, and they serve a purpose in time, at least in the primitive stages. And the degree to which we aren't choosing to be civilized, choosing to be, you know, moving into the advancing stages, we are effectively choosing to be subject to those corrective measures in the system, right? If you say, oh, you're not the boss of me, I don't have to be civilized, I can do any damn thing I please, well, then you're going to be subject to the cattle prods again, right? The harsh mechanism.
I'm Chris.
Yep.
Are we overpopulated in general, globally?
Well,
it seems like we are.
Let's hold off on that question till we get to the final paragraph, because that's, you know, it specifically speaks to that. Okay, so let's go on to the next paragraph here.
When the land yield is reduced or the population is increased, the inevitable struggle is renewed. The very worst traits of human nature are brought to the surface. The improvement of the land yield, the extension of the mechanical arts, and the reduction of population all tend to foster the development of the better side of human nature.
Okay, so, I mean, it seems in many ways, okay, didn't we just already talk about that? But they're re-stressing. They're trying to say it in a slightly different way to see if they can capture your attention. You know how your spiritual consciousness yearns for the better side of human nature to be more manifest. They're reminding you of the physics of that, right? That wishful thinking or whatnot doesn't get you that. You know, it's very foundational things. The improvement of the land yield, the extension of the mechanical arts, okay, and the reduction of population. And it's those basic elements. Okay, it's not, you know, law, passing more laws or redistributing wealth or, you know, instituting more regulations. No. Right? It's not directly. Right? I mean, it's these basic issues of you need better science, you need wisdom guiding the population issue, etc. Right? And obviously if you're gonna regulate population, that takes science. It's those arts of civilization, science, philosophy, religion, that you need, and you need to think about the basic physics, like they're saying, how it's all tied to the land. That the land, that groundedness, that actual groundedness of mankind, can't ever be forgotten about. If you do, you'll regret it eventually.
But if you don't, you foster a better human, better side of your human nature.
Yeah.
Which is what?
Well, and so, yeah, that's what I was just going to bring in. So, and then the other element is just the fact that they're saying that there's the very worst traits of human nature. You notice it didn't say animal nature, right? And then contrast the better side of human nature. Okay, so they're giving you the benefit of the doubt of being human and not just a problematic animal phenomenon. Okay, but why is there, you know, the very worst traits of human nature? Because all of us are imperfect. And once you start to actually bring in spirit energy and its potential dominance over mind, once you actually start to be more spiritual, so that there's spirit influence upon your mind energy, right, it's in your sovereign hands, right, in your inner life, what that spirit over mind influence does. Does it take the imperfections that we all inescapably had? None of us are born paradise citizens, right? Perfect. Right? Does that spirit influence pour gasoline on those imperfections? Does it take those imperfections and amplify them so that they manifest in the horrendous, you know, outpouring? Or do you take a hold of those and say, yes, I have these imperfections, but I'm not going to do what's natural for those imperfections to do? You know, those imperfections are going to definitely respond negatively to a negative stimulus. They're even going to have tendencies to respond negatively to a positive stimulus, right? If they're deep divots. Right? You're going to have to take control of that mind and get, you know, work above those imperfections, overrule those. But a human can do horrendous things like no animal, right? Because a human can bring spirit influence to bear upon those animal tendencies. Right? And that means you can bring infinity and eternity into play upon those animal tendencies. So an animal will do something, you know, that we'll call horrendous for a short period of time and in a very localized space. But see, the human brings in infinity and eternity, right? And so it isn't so localized anymore. It manifests over a vast domain, death as far as the eye can see, because you're bringing infinity into play. You want the phenomenon to be infinity-like, and you don't want it to be just a fleeting thing. You want it to go on and on and on. You want it to be eternity-like. Right? See, the problem with humans is that they can be worse than animals because they're spiritual. They can bring spirit upon that mind, okay, and extend it outward in space and, you know, forward in time. Okay. When you see horrendous evil, I see that's where it comes from. Right? The fundamental source of that horrendous phenomenon is spirit. Very unfortunate use of spirit over mind. Right? You'll never see a carnivore do such a thing because they can't wield spirit over mind. They can't, you know, spread out their flash of I'm hungry glom onto something and eat it. Right? They're very just matter of fact and practical about it. Humans bring in this very artificial, unfortunate extension of it into play.
In the name of God.
Right, and then, you know, if it's juiced up, it may even be in the name of God, sure. Right. If your name of your notion of God. Yeah, so just between the lines they're bringing in the double-edged sword. So you start with social, you move to cultural, and you're wanting to get to full-on personal civilization, but now you definitively have the double-edged sword. It can potentially be very wonderful or very horrendous, and there's nothing natural about it being very wonderful, because the mind that spirit influence is imposed upon is imperfect by nature. Right? Given enough time, that spirit influence will always take those imperfections to unfortunate manifestations. That's why isolation of an individual is always bad. Right? They need to be bouncing off of others to help to mitigate, temper that, because every one of us have imperfections that if given enough time in enough of an isolated situation, you will begin to manifest in very unfortunate, cataclysmic ways in the world around you.
Unless you have some wisdom or whatever.
Yeah, right. But see, again, I mean, right, someone is, you know, challenges you to, you know, to get wisdom and stuff. I mean, we aren't very self-actualizing. You know, if we were quite self-actualizing, there certainly wouldn't be any helpers on the mansion worlds. They just plop you there, and you just, you know, flower into this beautiful thing. No, you need lots and lots of helpers. Because left to yourself, right, you don't have the big picture, and you're going to tend to take these imperfections and flip them around and say, oh, this is not an imperfection. This is actually something good. You know, and I need to pour more spirit on it, you know, to make it expand geometrically, you know, and overflow to all those around me.
Until it's the size of Titania.
Right. And that's what the deal is. So, you know, if you ever wondered why, you know, that question when people say, why are, you know, humans so much worse than animals? It's because we're spiritual and an animal isn't. They never bring in eternity and infinity, you know, as a fruit that they manifest. Yeah.
Trying to wrap my mind around that whole thing, how you can bring spiritual energy into play.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you have to have the personality in play? And you usually say we basically don't have that in play.
Yes, but remember, even if it's not consciously in play, when I'm talking all the time, I'm talking about consciously, your personality is always functioning superconsciously. It's always making choices. Are you going to say, well, yes, but those unconscious choices, those superconscious choices, those are all just in that properly set up by grace space that I was given at age 6. Not for very long. Remember, you start to drag stuff, unfortunate stuff, up into the temple.
Superconscious.
Yeah. It's all, your superconscious mind and your personality are always doing stuff. Whether, the question is, are these things that down the road you're going to be delighted with or not? Right? When suddenly a human manifests in a horrendous way, that's because slowly over time, superconsciously, mostly, right, there's been this unfortunate geometric expansion of the imperfections in their mind that's been going on. Right? At some point, you need to get up there and take a hold of the situation. You can't just let it take its natural course where those little things expand until they outflow into something horrendous. Right? You have to choose a positive future. It doesn't just happen naturally. Right? The only way a positive future could happen naturally is if your mind starts out perfect. Then as it just rolls on unconsciously, it's all groovy. But it doesn't start perfect. It starts imperfect.
So when you're choosing, your personality is consciously in play.
Yeah, there's unconscious choices and conscious choices.
Okay, I don't really get it yet.
right? It's just a that's a very important element in the revelation that your mindal self is mostly not conscious. Matter of fact, all of the important stuff that's going on in your mind is not conscious. We're not sophisticated enough for the conscious stuff to be really that important. The very important stuff is going on superconsciously. The decisions and choices that are going on superconsciously. Yep.
Are you saying that the choices that we consciously make could be throwing a wrench into the choices that are unconsciously being made?
You certainly want to start making conscious choices that overrule unfortunate unconscious choices. You don't want your personality to be beginning to to expand these initial imperfections in your mind. I mean, you wanted to give it something appropriate to work with. It's going to work with whatever's there. It's going to apply spirit to whatever's there. It's going to apply geometric expansion to whatever's there. See, that's why you can't just consecrate your will. Right? You have to consecrate your mind also. I mean, what's that will applying itself to? Unfortunate things or not so unfortunate things? That's in our hands.
So how do the unfortunate imperfections get there in the first place?
Because we're all made imperfect. Right? Now, like I said, I mean, initially at age 6...
Dust to dust.
Yeah, initially at age 6, the upper domain is in a perfectly coordinated state with the cosmos. Very limited, but it's a supreme thread, that initial encirclement in the Holy Spirit. But immediately in the wake of that starting point, right, you are beginning to drag stuff up from the lower domain and give it in an exalted position in the upper domain. Okay, from age 6 to, the later teens, not a lot, but definitely start getting into your 20s, okay, and you're definitely going to be unconsciously dragging stuff up into that upper domain and polluting it, right? And And it's not like your personality, your unconscious choices up there are going, oh, well, I don't want to apply myself to that. No, there's no off switch on that. I mean, it's just applying spirit influence to whatever you put up there. And if you put up something that shouldn't be expanded, it's going to be expanded anyway. Right? And the only reason that we all don't all just explode, you know, in a horrendous manifestation is we're all interacting. There's checks and balances in my interaction with other people, you know, that's mitigating, you know, something growing that shouldn't grow. Okay? That, you know, isolation is, you know how the Grand Book talks about that. Isolation is very dangerous, right? It's not dangerous for an animal that doesn't have any spirit influence on its mind, but it's dangerous for a human because things that shouldn't get bigger will get bigger.
But we do have to consciously overrule
right.
And parent that self.
Right. That's the whole thing of I can't just stay a child forever. I've got to start taking a hold of the reins.
Right. So we're saying consciously we're not really capable of doing anything.
If we're so fascinated with material things, there is no inner life. Hence, there is no, I need to get up there and discriminate. It's like, wait a minute, I don't want to apply any sort of geometric influence to that. That's not an appropriate thing to have expanding geometrically. You have to get up there and start discriminating. But there is no up there in that discrimination. If the outer life is so delightful, right? If listening to my voice is so delightful that that's all you want to do is be in the outer life with my voice.
Some people do that.
Right? See, there's no reflective life there. There is no inner life. Right? Because it's the lower domain that's listening to my voice, not the upper domain. The upper domain doesn't have ears. Okay? It's important, to take some time to think reflectively, to find that inner life. And, you go through a difficult adolescent transition from that child of God because you're going to start, okay, I need to take a hold of this, and down the road, oops, okay, that wasn't as great as I thought. Okay, there's a difficult adolescent phase where you have to learn by leaping a bit, but you've got to figure it out to get to that adulthood where you can rule your sovereign domain as it needs. You know, it's a sovereign domain. It must be ruled. It doesn't self-rule. Right? That's the third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto, that upper domain self-rules, and it's innately perfect. Right? It doesn't. It must be ruled. Left unruled, you will become unruly. Okay, you will become an antisocial phenomenon that is just going to be a horrendous thing for all those around you.
Well, thanks. I get the whole picture much better now.
Yeah.
Glad you did.
Right. So if you,
just came at the end of this conversation.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Well, where were we? We just did that one.
We're about to talk about color.
We're doing the contrast of the positive and negative human nature. Okay, yep, go to the next paragraph.
Frontier society develops the unskilled side of humanity. The fine arts and true science, scientific progress, together with spiritual culture, have all thrived best in the larger centers of life when supported by an agricultural and industrial population slightly under the land-man ratio. Cities always multiply the power of their inhabitants by either good or evil.
All right, so again, they're bringing in that the land issue again. Just keep stressing that. Most of that's straightforward. Notice how at times they don't want to leave it to your recognition, so they'll put in the adjective just to stress it. Spiritual culture, right? Like I've been saying, right? That's the difference between mere society and culture, is you have the beginnings of rudimentary unity influence in play with the sixth adjutant. Okay, just stressing that.
So slightly under the land man ratio,
right? So
that mean less population.
I mean that ratio decreases. So I mean you're going to need, you need workers. A lot of workers for agriculture and industry. Right. So, the denominator increases, the ratio decreases.
So there's enough land to support those workers, what you're saying.
Right. You have a given amount of land, but you got a lot of people on that because they're doing this intensive farming on it, or all of this.
You have more land than it's, I guess.
Right. They're just, they're just pointing out that, you don't have a uniform land-to-man ratio, because you've got the differentials, like you've got the agricultural and industrial regions and, so relative to the general, there's going to be a greater focus of people in those locations. And then just, obviously, when you've got more people in a space, cities always, you have all of this associativity potential for good or for ill, as they're pointing out. So this whole bit of, just when we're, we're talking about me as an individual, if I don't take control of myself and there's this unfortunate expansion of very problematic divots in my mind to the point where they flow out in some horrendous manifestation, if I'm all alone in the middle of the wilderness, not a lot of consequence. But if there's thousands of people all around me, they all die. Right? Yeah, right. Not to mention, see, and that's the next step. It's bad enough when there's just a single individual manifesting negatively in a group, but there's the mob mentality, right? I mean, there's an interplay, right? And one person is a seed, and the next thing it's infected the whole group, and everyone is now overflowing these unfortunate inner, inclinations. Okay? And the more spiritual people become, the quicker a group can go bad. Because all the pumps are already primed when everyone has some spiritual consciousness. So, it can, in a flash, everyone can be manifesting. You don't have to get them all cranked up, and spiritually energizing some unfortunate inner thing. It's already energized, and all it needs is just a little spark, to set the whole group aflame. Yep.
This was recognized by the Indians when they were confronted with white settlers. Because the Indians, before going on the warpath, they had to gather and they had to work themselves up into fighting frenzy.
Right.
For the white settlers, they were always ready to ready to go at it.
Uh-huh.
Their rifles were locked and loaded all the time.
Yeah. See, so again, that's that's the difficult adolescence, of your maturity. You have enough spiritual consciousness to be potentialized, but you haven't gone up to really take control and get a hold of the reins and guide it well. You're more open to demagoguery when you're in that initial spiritual maturation stage, etc. Right? That's the difficult transition that we're in. And you're either quivering on the very brink of doing something positive with all that potentialization or something very unfortunate with all of that potentialization. Let's see here. What else do we have there? I think we got everything there, didn't we? Yeah. Let's keep going.
The size of the family has always been influenced by the standards of living. The higher the standard, the smaller the family, up to a point of established status or gradual extinction.
Okay, so you notice to give a whole paragraph to that basic element. Just they want you to reflect. Do we not have this issue in play in the world today? Right, the leading societies are getting into this mode where you don't even have two kids, so it's station keeping, right? Like to point out, something that could, it's like, well, I can go to this small family, but no smaller. Maybe it's like there's some established status. Maybe the mores say that, you aren't a proper family if you don't have at least four kids. So
you say the Mormons? I think it's seven, right?
I'm not doing anything specific and just bringing out something arbitrary, right? Okay? But see, there may be something that the society has set up so that you've got this higher and higher standard of living thing that's driving you to smaller and smaller people in the family. But it's like, but our mores say that you can't go below this. But you throw out the mores, which we've tended to do in Western civilization, okay? Well, then there's no artificial barrier, right? It goes below two kids, okay? If there's only one kid, in one generation you have two people, in the next generation you have one person, right? There's gradual extinction in play, not to mention, we're not going to have any kids at all. Right.
And then there's the whole other
thing,
why having
22
kids, four wives.
Right, and we all know that on our planet we have people in all sorts of different stages, many of which where, there's nothing mitigating. There may even be mores that greatly exalt the more kids the better. See, and maybe that's a more set up in a very agricultural situation where if you don't have lots and lots of people to hoe the fields, everyone's going to starve. So, everyone's having as many kids as they can, and those sorts of things, Or that a lot of them are going to die in wars because, we're constantly killing each other in wars, so everyone's going to have lots and lots of kids, right? If you're still in those older more systems, you're producing lots of kids, but then these more developed peoples are thinking, we're not like that anymore. That's suicide. Give a few generations and the people having lots of kids will take over the earth. Yep.
I don't know. I try to understand a place like Haiti, which is people are very poor.
Yep.
It's a limited land area to start with. Mm-hmm. And it seems like the poorer they are, the more kids they have.
Yeah.
What's at work there that drives them to do that?
Well, remember, they were touching upon. Remember, you have this basic issue of by means of the arts and sciences increased the land yield. At the same time, the natural increase in offspring was somewhat brought under control. If you don't really have any sort of a scientific culture, right? Everyone's just rabbits. We're all just doing the natural thing. And breeding like rabbits, because everyone knows this thought of satisfying that hunger comes up frequently. Right? So if there isn't any way to mitigate that, you're just going to produce lots and lots and lots of kids. Right? We've got two things that can be taken to unfortunate ends, all good things taken to the extreme become bad. Those foundational aspects of men and women. Man has sex hunger, woman has maternal instinct. Maternal instinct needs something to apply it to. Right? If there's no baby, what's the maternal instinct going to be used for? Right? And there's always a guy that has a hunger that can do something about that. So, right? That's just the natural state. We naturally will overpopulate. If there isn't any sort of a higher internal regulation and science with it, to do something about that. And overpopulation is natural. But, we know that people are like that. Invariably, there's going to be famine and it'll wipe out vast numbers of them.
So it can be an indication of loss of cultural civilization, cultural
Yeah, I mean, you know, you need vast famines in, say, in Africa still. Like, we were just talking about that physics. Because they're all breeding like rabbits. I mean, right. I mean, if they won't self-regulate, I mean, the system will regulate you. It's just set up that way. It's hard to be overpopulated for very long. Or famine and pestilence will take care of the problem inexorably.
Well, especially when the church...
Right, right. And,
saying,
see, and if there's mores, right, see, that yeah. say, overrule that science stuff. See, that's just, you know, see, again, that's just because you've taken the old mores and religion has unfortunately, you know, you set them in concrete, right? And so, no, that's science stuff, and the new mores predicated on that, no, that's bad. You know, that we want the old-time religion, the old mores. Yeah. Okay, let's see, where were we again? We got everything there. Yep, keep going.
All down through the ages, the standards of living have determined the quality of a surviving population in contrast with mere quantity. Local class standards of living give origin to new social castes, new mores. When standards of living become too complicated or too highly luxurious, they speedily become suicidal. Caste is the direct result of the high social pressure of keen competition produced by dense populations.
Okay, give some basic issues about, you know, why class becomes caste. All right, I think it's pretty straightforward there for you to understand. Notice again the standards of living issue. Again, think about it in the basic developmental epochs. All right, when you're in the nutrition epoch and the security age, no one's thinking standard of living. It's only when you get to the material comfort era that that starts to come into play. And as they're pointing out, if you get deeper into the material comfort era, you can overplay some of these tendencies. You know, like they're saying there, when standards of living, you know, if a little standard of living is great, then higher quality is better. No, all good things taken to extreme become bad, as they're pointing out. Right? That quality, when it's not just quantity, when it starts to bring in quality, you can take that too far as well. Like you're saying, to the point where I want such a complicated, quote-unquote, high standard of living that there's no room for a child in that situation. So let's don't procreate. Okay. All right. Speedily become suicidal. Okay.
Good example. Yeah. See it happen.
Right, and we know, right, you know, some people it's the complication thing, some it's the, you know, highly luxurious, some it's both. And we all know that our society is just, there's more and more supposed needs in an ever more complicated society. I mean, it starts to get so many things that you think you need. I mean, there's no room for children in such a needy space. Okay, because children need things and you don't have anything left for their needs. I mean, it's taking you... You know, you barely have time to sleep to try to keep up with all your needs. I need to update my Facebook page, and I need to... Right, all these needs that you think you have now. Right? That's highly complicated. You know, so it's not just that kind of classic, you know, endless luxury sort of a thing. Just the simple complexity thing is driving society into a suicidal state here. No one's procreating, or if they are, they're not properly raising those children, you know, and they're rogue male elephants, you know, so you're breeding destroyers of your civilization. It's, you know, which is worse, you know, you destroying it in your selfishness, or your self-absorption, or you literally sending out these missiles of destruction amongst us. Okay, so they're trying to get you to think about the physics of this. No amount of spiritual consciousness, wishful thinking, whatnot, overrules these basic facts. And that's why there's an emergency, because we've lost sight of these basic facts. We're in the material comfort era where we have the luxury to set things up so that we can be our own worst enemy like this. Used to be that we didn't have enough time to be our own worst enemy. There's too much time trying to just keep from starving to death and being killed by the hordes. Okay, now...
Safe harbor.
Yes. Okay, so now it's going to bring in some rugged, politically incorrect stuff.
The early races often resorted to practices designed to restrict population. All primitive tribes killed deformed and sickly children. Girl babies were frequently killed before the time of wife purchase. Children were sometimes strangled at birth. But the favorite method was exposure. The father of twins usually insisted that one be killed, since multiple births were believed to be caused either by magic or by infidelity. As a rule, however, twins of the same sex were spared. While these taboos on twins were once well-nigh universal, they were never a part of the Andonite mores. These peoples always regarded twins as omens of good luck.
Let's just start with the last little statement. Can you think of a simple fact that might have set up a very enduring mores system amongst the Andonites in favor of twins?
Yeah.
Maybe Andon and Fonta. Yes. So notice the interesting consequences of that physical fact as it goes forward in a societal evolution. Okay, so back to the top of that paragraph. You start out with that very rugged fact of, right, they just killed deformed and sickly children. Think about where they might have gotten that idea. If they didn't generate it themselves, they watch animals, right? A mom just ignore the sickly, baby in the litter, for instance. Those sorts of things. Humans, between them, their gears grinding themselves and them watching animals, right? You set up mores like that where you just killed all of the children that were deemed inferior one way or another. We all know there's that whole issue with girl babies. But think about this in another way. It's not just that first thought you have of, oh, yes, the men all wanting boys and killing off the girls because they don't want them. And fortunately, we finally got, they were deemed valuable when you could sell them and they stopped killing them. So think about that, that's horrible that they would sell their daughters. Well, at least they weren't killing them. Yeah. I mean, come on here. That's an improvement. Right? In the evolutionary process, that serves a purpose. But the main thing that is not immediately apparent is, think about this. Lots and lots of boys, young men, are dying in battle. Right? They figured out very early on, this becomes very problematic to society, if you get too imbalanced between the sexes. So it actually kind of, there's an unrecognized of those primitive people desire for a symmetry there, to have the number of women roughly the same as the number of men, just as God's natural process does it. It's basically a 50-50, thing if it's natural.
A phenomenon. Having been a rancher,
yeah,
that I never really understood. When you have a herd of 500 cows, you're going to have almost always half the calves are going to be male and half are going to be female.
Yep.
It's an interesting thing. You know, you just have to say, right. This doesn't make sense.
But yeah. See, and again, it's the hand of the mother, right, that's doing that, that sees to that. You know, we look at it scientifically from our material science, you know, and, you know, it's like, well, no, it's just like a flipping a coin. It's a 50-50 thing. No, it's more sophisticated than that. Right, there's, you know, for instance, you know, if you study it carefully, you discover it isn't exactly 50-50.
No.
Right. See, it just shows you that it's not just a random process like flipping a coin, right? It's an imposition of a purposing in the whole, you know, through the individuality of the whole.
John was a rancher.
Are you a rancher?
No, you were a rancher.
Yeah, I was a rancher.
Okay, so back to the rugged things here. Besides killing the deformed and sickly children, that whole bit of infanticide, you know, the favorite method was exposure. And you can understand that, you know, it's out of sight, out of mind. You know, rather than just grabbing the kid in and wrenching its neck, you know, you put it off somewhere and then you walk the other direction and you're out of sight, out of mind.
Put him in the dumpster.
Right? So, I mean, our tenderness, he was, you know, biasing it there, you know. So, yes, it was still infanticide, but you know, you were sort of letting it happen naturally, letting the wild beasts or the, you know, the cold night or whatever take care of it.
Realizing that if you survived, you'd be raising that child.
but again, remember, this is, you know, there's goofy notions in play, but there's also, as I try to point out, there's these basic overpopulation things happening. Right, I mean, when they start thinking about, it's like, you know, if we just breed and breed and breed, there's too many of us, and we've discovered this over and over again. Well, maybe we should pick some way to cull the herd. Well, how about if we kill all the, you know, the deformed and sickly ones? See, and they're trying to do some, you know, eugenics, you know, some population control.
That could be done in a humane way. Right. Do it much more
right. Obviously, we, you know, taking this forward brings in a lot of difficult questions. But just trying to think back in the past first to understand the truths that are there in the past. You know, we all know you had these, you know, these superstitious things about twins. You know, that well, there must be magic or infidelity going on there. You know, to produce twins. But they go, wow, yeah, but if they look the same. It can't be infidelity, right? That didn't make sense. So there, you know, these various notions, but you know, they get to the main point here in the next paragraph. You know what we're building up to, this whole issue of what does a primitive society look like in contrast to a budding civilized society. Okay, read the next paragraph there.
Many races learned the technique of abortion. This practice became very common after the establishment of the taboo on childbirth among the unmarried. It was long the custom for a maiden to kill her offspring, but among more civilized groups, these illegitimate children became the wards of the girl's mother. Many primitive clans were virtually exterminated by the practice of both abortion and infanticide. But regardless of the dictates of the mores, very few children were ever destroyed after having once been suckled. Maternal affection is too strong.
Right, so that maternal instinct, you know, and then the feelings that result from that maternal instinct. You know, the maternal instinct itself is on the first level of meaning, the level of the flesh, but it casts the shadow of feelings onto the second level of meaning. That's that maternal affection that they're speaking of there. You know, so that's a very powerful thing. It, you know, it takes a lot for a woman to overrule that maternal instinct. And, you know, this is one of the reasons why those who want to foster abortion and infanticide, you know that they've got to somehow make it happen before the mother really identifies with the child. So, you know, you can see the very cold, calculating aspect of that going on amongst us today. And, you know, notice the not-so-subtle contrast there. More civilized groups. I mean, we have to face the fact that abortion and infanticide are not the hallmarks of even a rudimentarily civilized people. You don't have to literally set up a moray system where the illegitimate children become the wards of the girl's mother. There are, you know, but there needs to be a civilized approach to handling the complexities of the children of God. Right? We're all children of God, whether we're in a womb or not. You know, as we've stressed so many times, your value, your genuine value, we're talking about how they're trying to figure out how to use that word, but your genuine value is not in your actuality. It's like, well, there's more cells there, actually more cells, now it's valuable. No, it has nothing to do with the actuality. Certainly not to do with quantity, like the number of cells. Right? You know, you have value because of your potential. A single-celled human has just as much value as a human that's 12 billion years old. They both have a potential relationship to eternity. That's where their value is. You know, and a civilized people recognize that abstract fact of the value, that it's in the potential, not in the actuality. And so you set up, you have to be pragmatic. There has to be exceptions to rules and everything. We all know that. But the important point is just to face the fact that abortion and infanticide are primitive notions. If you want to be an advancing people don't have anything to do with such primitive notions. And that's just the way it is. You know, I mean, you notice they're being strong, you know. It was a custom for a maiden to kill, right? They use the word kill, right? You know, it's not some, you know, just a petri dish issue, right?
What about war? Isn't it just as awful?
Sure. Right.
Especially since this is
war kills too. I mean, there's all these complexities, but you know, right here we're just focusing on the one issue, you know, one step at a time. All right. And you know, facing that specific fact that you know, yes, there is a degree of greater sophistication, like they're pointing out, to abortion relative to infanticide. The most primitive people just did infanticide, eventually had enough scientific understanding that you could have abortion instead of just infanticide.
Yeah.
Yeah, but,
in this middle ground, I can just see an unmarried maiden is obviously pregnant, and then one day she's not. Nobody asks any questions.
Mm.
That wouldn't happen today,
or
sometimes it does.
Mm-hmm.
People have different sensibilities about it now.
Yeah, and the big thing that they don't bring out right here about abortion, that they, you know, they come back to it in the Marriage and Family Papers. You know, that's if you aren't familiar with where that is, that's. That's in what paper is that? That's paper 84, section 7. the ideals of family life. You know, that's where they point out that that the only thing that's changed relative to these primitive times with abortion is now, instead of having some taboo or whatnot that's you know, behind, you know, having the abortion, it's literally just because it's cutting into my individual pleasure. Yeah, remember how they word that up there? Ancient men exposed undesired children to die. Moderns refuse to bear them. Why? Because of the new function of pleasure lures. Right. So primitives, you know, had some notion for abortion. Have we improved upon that, or have we gone backwards? See, to have it being simply based upon pleasure lures is pre-primitive.
Not all are based on pleasure lures.
No, of course not. Of course not. I mean, we all know that there's practical issues, like I said. I mean, there are, you know, but just, we're talking about the mores system, you know, and we allow for exceptions to the rule. But just,
so there's also advances in science that don't even get you to that stage.
Yes, obviously, right. But it's just, you know, this is some of the rugged stuff where they're trying to get us to face the facts. Now, remember, this is not a spiritual issue. No real harm befalls an aborted child. Actual harm, yes, they're killed. Okay? But, you know, when they said that, and this practice became very common after the establishment of the taboo on childbirth among the young married. In other words, lots and lots of children in the probationary nursery. But they're in the probationary nursery. Right, they still get to eternity. No real harm befell them.
Even if neither of the parents survive?
Well, there is that qualification, right? If it's primitive enough where, you know, neither parent, you know, survived, okay, then the child is not resurrected in the probationary nursery. But, right. But of course, today, right, post-Pentecost, you know, right. I mean, pretty difficult for at least the mother to not be, you know, resurrected on the first mansion world. And, you know, so those children are resurrected in the probationary nursery. Okay. You know, and, you know, notice they're saying it's not just this planet. This is true on every planet. I mean, there's every local system, you know, because every planet needs the probationary nursery mechanism. I mean, this is a natural part. Abortion is a natural part of the process of an evolving civilization. But it's in the primitive stages. Right? I mean, it's like slavery. Right? Slavery has its place way back there in early times. But, you know, we all know that is nothing that anyone that's moving forward does. So if we're so definitive about no slavery, what's this blind spot, right, about abortion? They're trying to get us to face that and really, you know, think about this. We need to get some civilized mores system set up again here. All right. Anything else we need there? No, just now, if that isn't strong enough, you know, they throw in one more paragraph still.
Yeah, right.
Even in the 20th century, there persist remnants of these primitive population controls. There is a tribe in Australia whose mothers refused to rear more than 2 or 3 children. Not long since, one cannibalistic tribe ate every 5th child born. In Madagascar, some tribes still destroy all children born on certain unlucky days, resulting in the death of about 25% of all babies.
A lot of unlucky days.
Okay, so why did they throw in that paragraph? Is it because they want to make sure that, you know, that we're a properly educated anthropologist and know some of these anthropological facts? No, what's the point? Right? You know, it isn't all those anthropological facts. It's an initial sentence, even in the 20th century. They're trying to get you to see it properly. It's that primitive. Right? It's right there with eating every fifth child born. Okay? That's how primitive it is. That's the point they're trying to make. Okay? When it's, especially if it's done for no other reason than the pleasure lure. Okay? It's definitely that primitive and that horrendous. That's the point they're trying to make. And we need to face that. Now, we don't want to be another item in that list of with Australia and cannibals and Madagascar there. You want to be differentiated from that list. And you inconvenience me puts you in that list.
Well, we all know that China, up until just recently, when Mao Zedong said, you can't have more than one kid.
Yeah.
Well, that was for population reduction in their case.
Yeah.
And it still sort of persisted as a mores for them.
Yeah. And see, we were just talking about that. It was purposeful partial suicide, to go to one in the next generation to try to, bring the population down.
And you mentioned it before, and because they were looking more for male kids than female kids, they ended up now where they got way more men than they have women, which is kind of interesting.
Which produces all kinds of unfortunate societal tensions, yes. You don't expect males to be as well regulated as you would like in a circumstance like that. Anyway, so, those three paragraphs are pretty vigorous. it's just very unfortunate that we've gotten so sophisticated that we're befogged by much thinking about this. I mean, it's not a complicated issue. They're trying to point out it's a very straightforward issue, and it's very unfortunate. It's a certain hallmark of why this book is in my lap, that we are so primitive, even pre-primitive, about this. Right? There's no way civilization is going to endure. Notice what they threw in there. Many primitive clans were virtually exterminated by the practice of both abortion and infanticide. It's suicidal enough to just not have any kids. But when you're throwing in, you don't have any kids because you killed them all, that's really primitive. That's what they're trying to get at. Okay, so there's one final paragraph here, and this
is another one.
This deals a little bit more with it's got some politically incorrect things in it, yes, but setting abortion aside, but just the direct issue that you were asking about earlier about that of overpopulation, just in terms of us trying to manage that as a globe. Okay.
From a world standpoint, overpopulation has never been a serious problem in the past. But if wars lessened and science increasingly controls human diseases, it may become a serious problem in the near future. At such a time, the great test of the wisdom of the world leadership will present itself. Will your ancient rulers have the insight and courage to foster the multiplication of the average or stabilized human being instead of the extremes of the supernormal and the enormously increasing groups of the subnormal? The normal man should be fostered. He is the backbone of civilization and the source of the mutant geniuses of the race. The subnormal man should be kept under society's control. No more should be produced than are required to administer the lower levels of industry, those tasks requiring intelligence above the animal level, but making such low-grade demands as to prove veritable slavery and bondage for the higher types of mankind. Presented by a Melchizedek, sometime stationed on Urantia.
Okay, well, let's just step through it in order here. So that starts out, from a world standpoint, overpopulation has never been a serious problem. Like I was saying, because it's in a primitive state, it's self-correcting. I mean, you can never get overpopulated. I mean, guaranteed war, famine, or pestilence will take care of the problem. Right? So it's only when we get more spiritually conscious and more scientifically sophisticated where we can start to overrule the naturalness of war, famine, and pestilence. That's the naturalness. We start to be artificial, right? Personal, unnatural, and war and famine and pestilence diminish. Well, if wisdom doesn't increase at the same time those natural things are decreasing, we're going to have a problem. And you notice, see, they purposely said the wisdom of world leadership. So as you begin to move out of the material comfort area, you must get to the quest for knowledge and wisdom. Right? For this reason, if nothing else. Or overpopulation is going to produce a very ugly phenomenon. Yeah. Okay, so there's that. That the more sophisticated we get, the more we have to have this encompassing wisdom framework around what we're up to. It'd be this great test, like they're saying. And then they give us, so we aren't totally in the dark about this. They stress the basic physics of the situation. It's not what you might initially think, that we should foster the super normals, all the geniuses. No, we're a very limited potential, and those geniuses are actualizing all the potential. There's nothing left there, right? Not to mention, notice that they stress, it's not just that sort of, that line has spent its wad. but see, the multiplication of the average or stabilized human being. Right, the supernormal and the subnormal are, to some degree, unstable.
And then the mutant from the normal becomes the genius, which I thought was interesting.
There's always potential in the middle of the bell curve to produce the few exceptional individuals that every generation needs. But just recognize that you don't carry those forward because it's a tail, and so it's unstable. And you're going to start to have recessive instabilities building up if you try to perpetuate that. And so the basic physics of that you need to, as you start to get wiser about this, you need to limit the procreation of the supernormal. Right? There'll have to be mores where they don't procreate as much, as the center of the bell curve. Center of the normal distribution, right, as it's called, that bell curve.
Hard to know what's normal these days.
Yeah, right. There's that difficulty. And then notice it's a little more complicated, they're pointing out, with the subnormal, because it isn't just sort of the parallel to the supernormal where you need to, because there's some instability, you want to limit their procreation. You need them for that whole bit they mentioned. When supported by an agricultural and industrial population slightly under the land-man ratio, right? You need some of those that can be content being a lot like a lot of cogs in a big machine, because the greater civilization needs those. And of course, that's when it gets to the very politically incorrect statements there at the end of
the jobs nobody
involved. All right. Prove veritable slavery and bondage for the higher types of mankind. The higher, lower, thing is the politically incorrect there, of course, suggesting that there's a vertical differentiation. But in that regard, so that no one goes off on a false tangent here, notice that what they say there, they clarify at the end what they're talking about when they're talking about supernormal, normal, subnormal. See, that those tasks requiring intelligence above the animal level All right. But, okay, so like you've heard me probably say before, they use normal in two different modes in the Urantia book, horizontally and vertically. Here's where they're using it horizontally. These are all humans. You know, it's a horizontal distribution. It's above the animal level. It's a horizontal distribution where you have lesser, you know, intellect humans, greater intellect humans in the vast middle. Okay, this is normal in the horizontal sense. But in other places, they use normal in a vertical sense, where subnormal is subhuman. Subnormal is not subhuman here. It's obviously human. So they state it directly. Okay. So those other places, and you see subnormal, look to see if are they talking about subhuman. Okay. So you have to interpret the normal, you know, in the context. Is it horizontal or vertical use of normal? Like I was saying, I mean, just that difficult fact at the end of the contrast between the fact that spiritually we're equal, but mindly and material we're not. Right? You know, this subnormal, normal, supernormal has nothing to do with spirit, nothing to do with your relationship to the universal Father, your spiritual Father. You know, it's not a spiritual bell curve. It's just mind, you know, and predicated on some matter. Bell curve. So that's the challenge, you know. That's why we have this political correctness, because we've taken that spiritual equality and misapplied it to mind and matter. We're not all born equal. There's higher and lower.
Is that mostly due to the default, or is that always part of the evolution on the planet also?
It's all these distributions, these horizontal and vertical things are always a part. Now, on a normal world, you don't have subhumans that are shaped like humans, because you don't have the back mating like we did. Okay. The only subhumans are those that have literally gone to iniquity, right, and cut themselves off from their human quality of mind. You know, but we have individuals that never got human quality of mind. You know, they're literally subhuman, never got, you know, at least the seventh adjutant. Hence, no encirclement in the Holy Spirit, no personality bestowal. That's atypical, right, to have that back-mated subhuman stock. But everything else is on every world.
From my point of view, I just see that I only have to judge that as a horrible, horrible thing. But there's a lot of people that would just, everybody has to be equal, so in every possible way. So I'm just trying to come up with ways to understand it better. That's a really tough one.
Obviously, if start with yourself, and just, you know, you work on getting sort of properly into proper relationship with these facts. You know, face facts and adjust them to ideals. That's that proper balance and relationship that I'm speaking of there, so that you can achieve wisdom about such things. Don't expect to get such a clever, clear understanding of these things that you can enlighten others, though. It's very difficult to penetrate the initial assumptions that people have that don't allow them, you know, to get to this sort of objective relationship to the facts You know, you know that one of the biggies, because you said it, is that assumption that all men are born equal. And how, you know, in terms of the leading edge of civilization, it's only the United States that where we challenge ourselves to recognize the fallacy of that and say, no, not born equal, created equal, right? By a spiritual father. We're spiritually equal, yes, but not mindly and materially. You know, those immediately behind us in Europe, for instance, right, are predicated on all men are born equal. And, you know, recent thinking in the United States is going backwards to that European ignorance of all men are born equal. You know, you go farther back, you know, into more primitive people, and none of them think that all men are born equal. Right? You only get that notion of all men are born equal in your head when you become spiritual enough, right? When you're in the more leading edge of civilization, to have such a confusion. The less spiritual peoples, they face facts naturally. You know, right? I mean, like these very primitive people that they didn't believe all men are born equal, they killed the deformed and sickly children. They deemed them to be less. Right? See, you know, it's only when you get into that transition stage where you have a little bit of spiritual consciousness, you know, and it quickly overwhelms, and all men are born equal. But can you go beyond that, just that very fancy animal with a spiritual consciousness, to a human that recognizes, no, that's illogical. You know, that's in defiance of the facts. If nothing else, I think there's men and women, and they're different. Right? Yep.
In a way, America enjoyed a grace by being on the edge of a frontier society.
Yep.
Well, the frontier society is now gone,
yep.
And the grace that came with that is now gone.
Yep, exactly. You see that. See, once the frontier society was gone, you know, you notice they were talking about that. That's when things started to get problematic. You know, and after 100 years of that issue building, we've got problems in the United States. Yeah. Okay. We'll probably just do the little preface in the next section. But there's one little thing we want to do here first. That byline, it doesn't just say presented by Melchizedek.
No, one time. Yeah.
Sometime stationed on Urantia. Okay. So reflect on that a little bit. Okay. Is this one of the Melchizedek receivers? Now remember, I've tried to point out a little bit of reflecting, and you recognize that if it's one of the 12 Melchizedek receivers that's authoring, those are the Melchizedeks they give a first name to, like Machaventa or Mantusha or whatever. Okay? Huh, well, okay, so if it's not one of the Melchizedek receivers, but sometimes stationed on Urantia, well, is this just kind of an arbitrary stationing? Now think about it. What most likely, this is the dawn of civilization. This is very likely one of the 12 Melchizedek observers, right? Those 12 Melchizedeks that were there post Andan Infanta, pre Prince and his staff. Remember, we had a special situation on our world because we had this 500,000 years of pre Sangic will creatures, and so they had, you know, you couldn't have the life carriers guiding it post Andan Infanta. And there was a long pre-planetary prince, so they, very likely, this is one of those 12 Melchizedek observers that authored this paper. He's the one that knows of that which he speaks. He was there back in these very ancient times. You go, oh, that's why there was that kind of odd mention of Andonites? See, didn't that catch you? It's like, well, these taboos on twins were once well-nigh universal, they were never a part of the Andonite mores. It's like, wow, that sounds so like, you know, immediate, like they were there. Yeah, see, very likely. This is one of the Melchizedek observers that authored this paper. It's important to just stop and reflect on that byline a little bit, put the pieces together. Okay, I think we have enough time. It looks like a tiny little preface, but there's actually quite a bit of meat here. This is one of the most important little issues in the whole book here in terms of a pattern that they bring out in this preface.
Paper 69, Primitive Human Institutions. Emotionally, man transcends his animal ancestors in his ability to appreciate human humor, art, and religion. Socially, man exhibits his superiority in that he is a toolmaker, a communicator, and an institution builder.
Okay, so we see that they've got this curious tiny little three little paragraphs that they've broken this preface up into. So they start with one element here of to consider, to put into the your mix of facts. That this contrast between primitive human and literally just fancy animal. So think about that a little bit. Okay, so emotionally man transcends. Okay, appreciate humor, art, and religion. Religion is pretty obvious. If you don't have any relationship to spirit, I mean, how is there going to be any sort of primitive, even primitive religion? And art, that beginning sense of that there's a vertical aspect to you and you're seeking to orient matter to presage Morantia, genuine art. You're trying to give expression to that vertical dimension. Obviously, only a human is going to be attempting that. But humor. Think about that. What is it that's fundamentally transcendent there? In order for there to be humor, there has to be a little bit of an objective frame, right? That you're observing things. Oh, look at that. That's silly. Right? I mean, if you're down in that, right, there, you don't have that perspective, right? See, that very fact that you have a little bit of above yourself vantage point is where the chuckle comes from. Right, of humor. So just they're wanting you to just reflect a little bit on each of those elements. What is it about you that that differentiates you from an animal, even in a basic rudimentary way? And then also and they say socially, so individually and then collectively, you've got toolmaker, communicator, and institution builder. Okay, remember we went through all that development, even pre-human stuff. There's some rudimentary tool usage anyway. Okay, but obviously if it gets to real sort of purposeful tool making, instead of, oh, there's a handy chunk of flint I could use. Obviously it's getting human because, you're reflecting and getting precise about this. Yes, there's rudimentary communication, like say in Anna and Fonta's, parents, that sort of stuff. Right, but to get any sophistication of language, okay, then you've gone to humans. But see, both of those is like, those aren't like very definitively. It's more just a quality. It's a quality of communication. The quality of tool making differentiates the human from the animal. But the institution builder, that one, okay, that's very, no animals are establishing institutions. So that one really stands out. And they did that very purposely, that where you have one of those is very definitively in contrast to the other two. Remember, we're talking about society and stuff here. So this is the biggie there. What are they getting at? By the end of the preface, they make this clear. They're wanting you to reflect on exactly what it is in a human that gives you quote-unquote institutionalization. Where does that come from? What's the basic nature in a human that produces that? Okay, I won't answer the question because we're building up to it. Okay, what else do they say?
When human beings long maintain social groups, Such aggregations always result in the creation of certain activity trends which culminate in institutionalization. Most of man's institutions have proved to be labor-saving while at the same time contributing something to the enhancement of group security.
Okay, so one other little step. They haven't totally showed their hand yet on this, but you know, they're giving you a clue. They're actually wanting you to see if you can kind of get the answer before they give it to you. That's another reason why they've broken it up into three paragraphs like this. So you go, when human beings long maintain social groups, see how they're pointing out that you're getting out of the moment like an animal. You're getting this long-term thing happening, okay? And see, such aggregations always result, okay, so this is just, you know, naturally comes out in any human grouping. You give it enough time, and this always results that there's certain inclinations, these certain activity trends, which culminate in institutionalization. Using that very technical word too, that there's this certain mode that all human minds, groups of human minds, always get into. That's called institutionalization. You say, well, exactly why? Well, they're saying, well, okay, maybe it's like they're saying here. Most of man's institutions have proved to be labor-saving. Maybe it's just that whole path of least resistance thing. You know, we're kind of naturally lazy, and you know, and we discovered if we institutionalize it, you know, it's labor-saving. Well, yeah, but most of man's institutions, this doesn't fully explain it. There seems to be something more fundamental than just the pragmatism of it there. And it says, while at the same time contributing something to the enhancement of group security, well, okay, so they're saying it's helping with this going from the nutrition epoch to the security age and resolving those security age issues and getting to being able to get to the material comfort era. But you're still wondering what, but more fundamentally, rather than sort of in the rearview mirror, I mean, these are kind of, you're looking at, oh, that helps with group, that actually helped with group security, didn't it? Or actually, that actually saved, you know, on labor issues. See, that's all kind of looking back. Why did, you know, where is this motivation coming from in the first place, right? For you to institutionalize. And we all know that it's just, humans just can't help themselves. Everything they do, they institutionalize, right? Yep.
Is it council? Or is that the right word?
It's not the adjutants. It's something transcendent of the adjutants. Because remember how they started out at the beginning? They were trying to get you to think about how you transcend the animal. They're trying to get you to think about the basic human things that are transcendent of an animal. And one of those things leads to institutionalization. Let's quit teasing and get the final paragraph here.
Civilized man takes great pride in the character, stability, and continuity of his established institutions. But all human institutions are merely the accumulated mores of the past as they have been conserved by taboos and dignified by religion. Such legacies become traditions, and traditions ultimately metamorphose into conventions.
Okay, so there it is. Now, they don't spoon feed it to you. They want you to reflect. Oh, I've got three things. I've got legacy, tradition, convention. And they talked about what? Accumulated mores of the past. They're giving you a hint, right? And getting the legacies. Oh, legacies, past, traditions, present, conventions, future, right? The fact, a human doesn't just have the present and memories of the past like an animal. The human has a third element, right? The future. Because you're a personality, you have foresight.
Look before you leave.
that, right, there's the concept of the future in a human's mind. It's not in an animal's mind. And so you don't just have the traditions of the present. You extrapolate those in your mind, because you can consciousize the future, conceive of the future, right, into a convention. A convention is the extension of a present tradition into a future. That's what an institution is. Right? And that conventionalization of something produces an institution.
For instance?
Any institution, a marriage institution, a land institution, property institutions, whatever it might
religious
be.
Religious institutions?
I mean, religious institution, anything. You know, that they get into those details as you go forward in the paper. But just up front here, so they're trying to get you to reflect on what you have as a basic human. You have past, present, future, and here's a very important triplet parallel to that. Legacy, tradition, convention. Now, in a full human civilization, you go beyond legacy, tradition, convention to wisdom, insight, foresight in their full personal mode. That's your relationship to past, present, future. Wisdom, insight, foresight. But here we're looking at the foundation. Right? A human, no matter how primitive, has the concept of the future. And that turns traditions into conventions and establishes institutions. We institutionalize because we're trying to eternity-ize time. Remember, I was talking about that up front, you know, when we were talking about the manifestation of evil. Right? You're bringing infinity and eternity into how you're trying to think about things and work with things. You want to extend time into eternity, tradition into convention, establish these enduring, these, you know, to the point where you believe they're eternalized institutions. Okay? And notice how they mention your primitive religion is there. See, conserved by taboos and dignified by religion. Again, reminding you that we're going beyond mere society to culture. See, again, that you're bringing in that. Or they said civilized man takes great pride in the character, stability, and continuity of his established institutions. See, again, pride is a spiritual word. Applying it to these material phenomena, stability, continuity. See, the eternity-likeness, the eternalness, see, of these things.
Ongoingness.
You're thinking of them as existential. Eh? Yep.
Those three words mirror legacy. You can, character and legacy can be thought of together.
Uh-huh.
Stability and traditions can be thought of.
Continuity.
And
conventions, right? Yeah. So they're trying to get you to think about the patterns here, but see, it's fundamentally a human has the future, right? And hence you have conventions and institutions, and again, it doesn't have to be. All those come into play basically because of the unconscious functioning of your personality. Right? It's as if it's just in the adjutants. See, but it isn't really. Not even the seventh. Okay, not even the super animal adjutants. It's because you have a personality that's unconsciously functioning, imposing spirit influence on your mind and bringing tendencies to want the temporal and the spatial to be eternity and infinity. It's not just our institution here. God wants this institution, this religious institution, to be spread over the entire earth. Your concept of infinity, right? The whole universe, the whole earth, the whole world. See, that's that. You do that. An animal doesn't do that. An animal doesn't bring infinity and eternity into play unconsciously like that.
An animal doesn't pray for our bread for tomorrow.
Yeah.
Something like
that. Anything like that, yeah. Give us this day our bread for tomorrow, right? That's a future conscious human.
So pride is not quite the taboo that we tend to in this class make it?
Yeah, okay, so before we wrap
once in
up.
A while, it's okay.
Again, we mentioned this earlier because pride came up earlier. In a very primitive state, pride is a positive thing when vanity and stuff, is getting things going. But that's one of those that you quickly outgrow. You very quickly can take that to an extreme and it becomes bad. Because a long, long time ago, humans coined the phrase, pride goeth before a fall. Right? That's not just something we figured out in the last 50 years.
We're forgetting
it. Right. But again, it's when you just have those very primitive humans, there needs to be a little bit of spirit juicing of the mind, okay, to get things going. But very quickly, pride becomes a negative because it's so individualized. Yeah. So, okay.
Yep. Being a spiritual word, then how is it a positive?
It's a positive in just that very initiating state where it kind of sparks you, motivates you to, to not just lay there like a lazy blob. You get up and do something out of pride.
So then, if it's a spiritual word, it must be a higher value. And so it's not?
Again, initially, like I was saying, but see, just remember, almost immediately, you flip it around to a negative. Right now, you shouldn't think of pride as being positive at all. We're beyond that primitive stage. For us, any pride is negative. That's why even 2,000 years ago, the second there was any pride in those disciples, Jesus came down on them like a ton of bricks.
So then on a higher level, where we are not, is it a positive?
No. Mistaking
something spiritual as being positive.
Absolutely.
Right. See, again, remember, pride is a spirit is a double-edged sword. And with pride, that double-edged sword is almost immediately the negative edge.
Chris said it becomes obsolete.
Yeah, it's definitely, you outgrow it. It becomes obsolete very ancient, very primitive times.
Okay.
Basically, beyond square one, it ceases to be a positive.
Okay.
As soon as you take your first step, it's now a negative. But it got you to take a first step. That was a positive. But after that, it's a negative.
Why is it a spiritual word?
I guess it just is. That's what the word pride is referring to, a spirit influence on your mind. Humans haven't recognized that, but it is. An animal can't be prideful. They can't juice up their mind. They can't animate their mind like that. That's a spirit influence on the mind. Okay. All right, so yeah. So like I was saying, just keep that always in your back pocket. That legacy, tradition, convention. That's a very important triplet to remember. That eventually, when you finally get to the modern civilization paper, you finally wrap up this whole civilization thing. They come back around to that and give you wisdom, insight, foresight to pair with it. So it begins with legacy, tradition, convention, and culminates in wisdom, insight, foresight. All right. Well, so we'll get into the details, the specific institutions here, next time, we'll see if we can find some more politically incorrect things to talk about. All right. Let's take a moment, everyone.